Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. During the last election cycle, a number of traditional conservatives and Republicans began to identify as never Trumpers. Some actively worked against his election. They failed. As we approach the 2020 election, with the president running again, his approval rating is a mere 49% among most Americans. But among Republicans, he has a 90% favorability rating. And yet, there remains a group of never-Trumpers who are working once again to see him defeated. The president has referred to them as human scum. That's a quote. Even as they return the name-calling with television ads and appearances on various cable TV news programs. The website 538 says the argument of never-Trumpers goes like this. Trump is a much worse person and leader than other recent GOP presidents. Democrats and Republicans who disagree on issues should put aside those differences for now and unite in opposing Trump because he is a threat to fundamental American values like the rule of law. And finally, they say, there is a sizable block of Republicans who will join with Democrats to challenge the president's re-election. Is that true? Are there really enough never-Trumpers out there willing to vote against their own party and for the candidate of the other party to successfully blunt the election efforts of an incumbent with an enormous war chest? We talk about that on this Politics Monday with Steve Tellis, a professor of political science at the Johns Hopkins University and the co-author of Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Bob Orr is here. He's all over the news this morning. He's a North Carolina attorney, former justice on both the State Court of Appeals and the North Carolina Supreme Court, a delegate to the 2016 Republican National Convention. He said there he would not vote for his party's nominee, Donald Trump, because, quote, he would be a danger to the country. He has since become the national spokesman for and the co-founder of a splinter group of non-Trump Republicans calling themselves the National Republican Party. Welcome back to the program.
My pleasure. It's great to be talking with you this morning.
And let me begin with you, Bob, because you're a North Carolinian. You've been a staunch Republican. You ran for governor here as a Republican. Then 4 years ago, as I said, you refused to support the president's nomination at the Republican convention. What was it about Donald Trump before he took office that made you believe that, in your words, he was unfit for the office?
Well, you look at his background, he had absolutely no real qualifications to lead the country as president of the United States. His persona, the way he treated people, the way he lied about important issues, his simplification of complicated policy questions. He was a man who would say anything and do anything, and his whole career was based on that. And I think the tipping point, and I've been asked this several times, was that when he essentially attacked Senator John McCain because he had been a prisoner of war. And I thought at that time, you know, there is no hope for this person. And I would like to say 3.5 years later, he has proved me correct in spades.
So this morning on both WBTV and in the Charlotte Observer, there's this story about the shadow convention that your National Republican Party is planning to hold here in Charlotte concurrent with the Republican National Convention, should either of these conventions actually take place in this COVID-19 era in which we live. You call the convention, according to the paper, an effort to give a dramatically different perspective on what the Republican Party has been historically and what it should be in the future. But Larry Shaheen, who I know you know, who is a Republican consultant from Charlotte, called you and your donors misguided. He says these are just people throwing a temper tantrum because their chosen person didn't win in 2016. They have no chance of changing any outcomes in this election. And you yourself are quoted as saying, it's amazing to see the people who've come out now that they realize we're not walking the plank alone. Is that how you see this effort, walking the plank?
Yeah, it is in some respects. I mean, obviously, we're going to be attacked by Republican operatives, and you know, Trump attacks at a national level people who are opposing him and contradicting all of the lies and things that he says. But what I have seen over the course of the last several years is lots of disparate Republican voices, conservative voices around the country, but there was never any sort of cohesive way of bringing everyone together. And we've seen a number of organizations, Stand Up Republic, that Evan McMullen runs, that I've been involved with, the Lincoln Project, Principles First. And so the convention concept was to let's bring everybody together so that the public, the voting public, and particularly swing voters, critical voters who don't like Trump but aren't necessarily comfortable voting Democratic, they can see that there are all of these Republicans, both from the national level to the state and local level, with impeccable Republican credentials, who are saying this man should not be reelected. He is a danger to the country, and I would submit a danger to the Republican Party long term.
Dr. Tellis, in your book, you call this intra-party opposition to Donald Trump unprecedented. Is it unprecedented in terms of the number of GOPers who oppose Donald Trump, or is it unprecedented in that the opposition has continued through the last election and into his entire term in office so far?
Yeah, thank you for having me. The thing I would emphasize is we want to distinguish between what I would, in political science, we would talk about as sort of the mass electorate and the party and professional elite. When it came right down to it, there was very little defection by the mass Republican electorate. Now, there's a little bit of an issue here in measurement in that there's attrition out of their Republican identifiers, right? So there are people who would, you know, 5 years ago would have called themselves Republicans, and now they're out of that category, right? So when you said 90% of Republicans are supporting Trump, is a fact, but it also is because a lot of the people who would have opposed Trump are now independent identifiers. So you want to keep that in mind. But the core, we argue, of Never Trump was always in a few of these professional providers of services to the Republican Party. In the book, we talk about national security professionals, lawyers. Lawyers are a special case. Bob can talk about that some more. Political professionals, economists, public intellectuals. These were the people who really opposed Trump in the most intense way. And in part, that was because Trump, in some quite significant ways, had directly rejected their role in the party. If you look at the national security professionals, for example, Trump had directly said that he didn't want to take advice from that large group of people who traditionally were providing national security advice to the Republican Party. So it's not, you know, a complete surprise that they responded in kind. But again, I think that's where the really intense opposition was. And it, again, I think it was historically unprecedented, right? There were examples in 1964 and the Republicans 72 in the Democrats. You can go all the way back to 1912 when the Republican Party splits off. You know, that's the, but in the modern era, this is a much wider and deeper scope of opposition than we've seen to a party's own nominee.
But over time, there have been a lot of traditional conservative Republicans who have bit the bullet, if you want to call it that, and decided to side with Donald Trump and support him hook, line, and sinker. And the entire United States Senate would be one group of them. Most of the Republican House members are Donald Trump supporters. The entire Fox News apparatus, if you want to call them conservative Republicans, I don't know if they fit in that bailiwick, but they're certainly economic Republicans. Most, because they're making money off of this, most of those people have converted over to Trumpism. So how powerful can Never Trumpers be, Stephen Tellis, in an environment, and how do you explain this blind loyalty to a personality and not to the party anymore?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it blind. So one thing in the process of writing the book is I tried, and my co-author Rob Saldine at University of Montana, tried to be sympathetic with the people who ended up not going with Never Trump. And the way we did that, we, in the process of writing this book, we read some really interesting articles by a Yale political scientist named Milan Svolik, who's done these surveys of the public where he looks at what he calls the trade-off between democratic or constitutional values and policy preferences, right? And so you imagine voters on the one hand have certain beliefs about how the political system ought to operate, what is sort of, you know, ethically legitimate behavior and democratic leadership. And on the other hand, they have beliefs about, you know, about abortion, about taxes and everything, right? And what Trump showed, right, is there was a trade-off there, right? There were voters who, especially in a polarized era, to oppose their own party meant voting in a party that, a rival party that's very far from their ideal policy positions, right? And that's one of the consequences of polarization, is that perceived distance between the parties keeps getting larger and larger and larger, right? If everything was just between the parties was between the 40-yard lines, right? Then having to sort of support the other party in order to punish your party for nominating a demagogue would not be that big a deal. You'd only have to give up those 20 yards, right? But if it's between the 10-yard lines, right, then you'd have to give up an enormous amount of policy, right? To the point where you might be worried that the continued survival of your own group would be under threat, which is what people were saying in 2016. So I think that's one of the reasons why, at least among the mass electorate, there was so little defection, is the worry that, you know, if the only way to punish Trump was to support Hillary Clinton, right, then that was that was just too far. That was more than even people who were disgusted by Donald Trump were willing to do. Mm.
So you have that problem, and then you have the problem of, I think, the changing nature of people in the who identify as Republicans, the electorate, not necessarily the people who are elected, but the people who are voters, because many of them had great grievances, which is accounts for why a lot of them voted for Donald Trump and why a lot of them preferred Donald Trump over the more traditional Republican candidates that ran in 2016. So, Bob Orr, when people like you become Never Trumpers and you launch this National Republican Party and you try to encourage people to vote in a different direction than Donald Trump, are you actually exacerbating the problem? Are you adding fuel to the fire of these people who did not trust traditional Republicans in 2016?
Well, I think our focus is to reach out to a lot of people like us who were registered Republicans or within the last several years have become disgusted with not just Donald Trump, but the way the Republican Party generally has operated. And they're now unaffiliated. I think the professor was talking about making that distinction between those that have stuck with the Republican Party. And I'd say there's a pretty substantial divide among the group that I've been working with and talking with about, is the Republican Party as we once knew it salvageable, or post 2020 does it really have to be a new party created, sort of a center right responsible party? But I think it's critical. We all want to sort of put the focus on Trump, which is exactly what he likes. You know, it's all about Trump, but there are many particular policies and principles that need to be focused on other than just Trump.
We'll talk about all of that. We'll also talk about this idea of a third party having any kind of impact in a country that has traditionally had only two parties, and that seems to be a two-party system that only works that way. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Never Trumpers And we have one with us, Bob Orr, a former member of the North Carolina Supreme Court, a constitutional conservative, and the co-founder of the National Republican Party. And if you read the paper this morning, you know that they will be holding or plan to be holding a shadow convention concurrent with the Republican National Convention be held here in August. Dr. Stephen Tellis is also with us, professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University and the co-author of Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites. How many, if you could get all the Never Trumpers in the room at the same time, could you fill up the Spectrum Center where the Republican National Convention is going to be held, Bob Orr? Could you fill it up? I mean, how many are you?
Well, more and more and more each day. And I think the challenge, of course, as a practical matter, we're dealing with a pandemic issue that we don't know how that's going to impact it. And so now I think our concept for, we call it a shadow convention, but I'd really rather refer to it as an alternative convention, where a different set of voices articulating different principles, different goals, different beliefs can be broadcast to the world, literally, so that the ranting and the hate-filled speeches and the personal attacks and the lies and distortions that you'll hear when Trump and his cronies take the stage, that there is a real alternative voice for people to evaluate.
You have said that Donald Trump has rigged the Republican primaries. I take it by that you mean that he has convinced states not to hold them, and therefore right. No one can run against him. Had he not done that, would you be putting forth a candidate?
Well, I voted for Governor Weld, who actually did get in the North Carolina primary. I actually helped get him on the ballot in North Carolina. But there are a lot of states where the Trump machine and the RNC put their finger on the state party, or this, and no primaries were held. It's always difficult to challenge a sitting president, though, in a primary.
Yeah, and we are not a parliamentary system, and historically we've only had two parties in this country. They've changed names, they've changed allegiances, they've changed memberships over the years, but really only two parties. The third party always comes in as a spoiler and drains votes from a candidate that might have won against the other party had they not run. So, why bother? I guess is the question.
Well, we need two viable, responsible political parties at a minimum. And you know, maybe we need, we got a lot of parties, they're just not viable. But the Republican Party is on the verge, in my opinion, and Steve can weigh in from the professional political science perspective. I think it's a dying party. I see, you know, I use my family as an example. I have two children and a wife who were registered Republicans, who not only are no longer registered Republicans, but won't vote for any Republican candidates. I mean, they are just totally soured on the on Trump and the Republican Party. And you can't sustain a long-term viable political party based on hate and lies, which is the, you know, the primary modus operandi of Trump.
And Stephen, tell us, you can chime in on that, but in your book, I think it's in your book, you said that in 2016, in some circles, that Never Trumpers looked like little more than, quote, the pitiful last gasp of a decadent, exhausted, and now vanquished elite. But still, you say, they fight on. To what end, and are they tilting at windmills here?
That was a pretty good sentence, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great.
We work real hard in that sentence. So one thing I think that's important to say here is that the Republican Party had a lot of problems before Donald Trump. And I do think the people who were arguing that the Republicans needed to rethink their policy approach before 2016, some of whom were warning that something like Donald Trump was going to come if the Republicans didn't alter their approach, in some sense, catch up with the fact that their voting base was changing, that it was becoming more working class, and that they the Republicans didn't have a working class economics, and that that's what Trump, in large part, took advantage of, right? That everybody in the 2016 primary was all competing to win what you might call the Koch primary, to appeal to that particular wing of the Republican Party. And that left a complete lane open for Donald Trump. And I think that's where it's really important to distinguish between people who oppose Trump because they thought that he in particular represented something insidious, something demagogic, and people who oppose Trump because they didn't like where he was moving the general ideology of the party, especially on economic issues. And so you had Never Trumpers who came in on either side, and then you had people who were conflicted, a lot of people who are what we call reformicons, who had been trying to get to something like Trumpism, but with a, you know, with a human face, for quite some time. And that's where they felt really boxed in with Trump, right? They hated Trump, they despised him personally, but they felt like in some sense he was pushing the party ahead on their own internal fight against the more libertarian economics of the party.
How do you explain people like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, who was viciously attacked by then-candidate Trump during the 2016 cycle, and Lindsey Graham, who also had very flattering things to say about Donald Trump prior to his election, and all of them are now in the fold? How do you explain that?
Well, politics is binary, right? I mean, it's easy for people like me to say that Lindsey Graham or Ted Cruz ought to take another position, but you know, again, the point I made earlier about political polarization. Political polarization means that the parties are much further away from each other than they used to be. You know, you think about the era when it was Jim Hunt and Jesse Helms, right? That seemed pretty far away at the time, but that seems like a lost era of moderation compared to the era that we're in now. And so during the primary, remember, all those guys were having a choice between Republicans, right? That is, they got to oppose Trump without necessarily having to do so by supporting a party of a very, very different ideology, right? And so it's not a surprise that they were willing to open up both barrels on Trump in that context. But the context is very different where, you know, you're getting, as Bob can talk about, right, where you're getting lots of Republican judges on the court, and where you're having to imagine a world in which all of those spots would be, you know, being filled by Democrats. That's just a really hard nut to crack. The other thing I would mention, and I think what Bob's doing is really important work, Republican opponents of Trump are very slow off the mark to really build an actively Republican opposition. A lot of the things that you talked about, like Stand Up Republic, were very consciously nonpartisan opponents of Trump, right? Or organizations. They were in tax terms, they were like C3 or organizations like that. And what really needed to happen right off the bat in 2017 was an active, organized Republican opposition to Trump. And that didn't really happen, right? That what we call factional conflict didn't really emerge, and is really only now emerging. So in some sense, the Republican opponents of Trump within the party, of actively fighting over who's going to control the party, that work is years behind where it needs to be.
Yeah, and I would submit that at least in the people I've dealt with and talked with, it's not so much who controls the party, but what does the party represent? You know, I mean, I've worked 45 years of my life trying to build a two-party system in North Carolina and growing the Republican Party. And now, you know, they think I'm an outcast, that, you know, they don't think I belong in their party.
And so does that mean that the party of Lincoln and the party of Ronald Reagan is gone?
It's on life support. And I think the question is post-Trump, and I think he will lose, and we don't have to, and I'm sort of digressing, but we as Republicans against Trump, don't have to deliver millions of votes. We just have to deliver the margin of victory in key states.
But like that doesn't solve that. But that doesn't solve the problem. Even if you're right, even if the Democratic nominee, we're assuming it's going to be Biden, but somebody else could be the. But even if that person wins and defeats Donald Trump, that doesn't solve the problem of what led to Donald Trump. This populist anger and frustration that somebody was looking for somebody to be the standard bearer for. That preceded Donald Trump. It will follow Donald Trump, even if he serves another 4 years. So what do you do about that?
Well, and I think that's the great challenge that we're all punting to post 2020 election. There's a certain number of people who feel the Republican Party can't be saved. Yeah, it's going the way of the Whigs. And so a new party that's not Trump centric and sort of anti-immigrant, free trade and anti-international concept can't survive. So there'll have to be a new one. There's still those that say we can save it. If Trump and all these people, the Lindsey Grahams of the world, either lose or they lose the Senate and they see what this kind of leadership has done to the Republican Party, they will be more willing to come back towards the principles and standards that we think the Republican Party should stand for.
Yeah, can I just say, go back to your question before, it is a little bit of a stretch to call the Republican Party in North Carolina the party of Lincoln. It was at least as much the party of Nathan Bedford Forrest, to be honest.
Whoa. Professor.
I'm going to go a little, to go to the point, it is the case that, third parties are not viable in the United States. And globally, there's lots of places with third parties. Some of those, even in places that have first past the post elections, like we do in the United States, they have third parties because they have regional parties. So in Britain, they have first past the post elections, but they have a Welsh National Party, Scottish National Party gets lots and lots of seats, but we don't really have regional parties like that. Maybe at some point, there'll be a Cascadia party in California, Oregon, and Washington that'll be sufficiently geographically distinct. But the consequence in the United States is, historically, we've had party factions organized, deeply institutionalized divisions in the party, right? Going back to the 50s, 40s, right? We had a very strong Southern Democratic faction in the Democratic Party. They were a really distinct, organized, group and a progressive wing of the Democratic Party. The Republican Party had a mainstream or stalwart faction and a conservative faction. That's the more traditional way that American parties work, as they work through negotiation between organized factions. And the unusual thing about the last really decade or so is the degree of homogeneity of both the parties, the degree to which they haven't had factional conflict. But I think that's really what the future is. I published a paper with the Niskanen Center, where I'm a senior fellow, called The Future is Faction. And I think that's really the future of the Never Trumpers, is to be the kind of intellectual and professional leaders of what will probably be a minority faction in the Republican Party, but a pivotal one, right? One without which the more dominant populist Republicans won't be able to govern, won't be able to get control of institutions. And in that sense, I think we're going to be going back to an earlier but more typically American form of parties, where you're going to have party factions that both fight against one another and then they fight together after having sort of come to a modus operandi in general election against the other party.
So I have to take exception several minutes back Steve has got his degrees from Maryland and UVA. He hasn't been to North Carolina to get a degree. So we need to get you down here. But the Republicans in North Carolina, my great grandfather, who was a farmer just down the road, refused to fight for the Confederacy, went over the mountains into East Tennessee and joined the Union Army, came back after the Civil War as a Lincoln Republican. And I say I come by my Republican roots honestly. And the convention of 1868, the new constitution for North Carolina, was a Republican dominated document that was very, very progressive in so many different ways. So the Republicans in North Carolina were not Nathan Bedford Forrest and his followers. In fact, they were trying to put the thumb down, if not the hammer down, on Republicans here. And it wasn't until Nixon's Southern strategy, where we picked up all of Nathan Bedford Forrest's descendants, that the Republican Party really went south. Literally.
So in your book, Dr. Tellis, you examine three groupings of Republicans and how they have reacted to the Donald Trump Party, and they are elected officials, a group you call policy demanders, of which I may need a definition for, and professionals, people who provided service to the party. I guess those would be consultants and lawyers and others. And the lawyers seem to be malleable. They seem to quickly fold into the Donald Trump Party. Is that because it was all for avarice, for money, for greed, whatever it took to get the party's money?
No, again, I think one of the things, the professional deformation of being a political scientist, is we're more likely to see certain things as being all in the game. And I think the lawyers, the lawyers cut a deal with Donald Trump. And part of it is that Donald Trump, his vision of a reconstructed Republican Party didn't involve dramatically moving away from what the pre-Trump orthodoxy was in at least where the judiciary is concerned. Now, the actual operation of the executive branch, as Bob will tell you, is a whole nother story where constitutionalism is concerned. But the lawyers, again, who were in many cases were aligned with social conservatives, Trump had a sort of sixth sense for power and who really has it. And I think he recognized that the lawyers, particularly because their relationship with social conservatives, were a group you could not cross. But he saw the national security conservatives, the people who were advising people about defense and foreign policy issues, and he looked at them and said, these people actually don't have power. These people don't, you can cross them. The belief among previous candidates that you had to go and bend your knee to this group of people turned out to be a miasma. And so I do think that with lawyers, the reason that they were willing to cut a deal with Trump was because they recognized that they were going to get what they cared about most, which was the judiciary.
Dr. Stephen Tellis is professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, author of Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites. He is here with Bob Orr of the National Republican Party. We're coming right back. If you're looking for more conversations around local and national politics, then look no further than Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte. WFAE's new podcast covering the RNC and the 2020 presidential race through the lens of Charlotte. Listen to Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org/insidepolitics. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Never Trumpers and what they will do going forward. Who do they vote for? Who do they support? What is their plan? Bob Orr is one of them. He's a constitutional conservative, former justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court, a Never Trumper, and a spokesperson for the National Republican Party, which he helped to co-found. Dr. Stephen Tellis is a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University and the co-author of Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites. Bob, anti-Trumpers point to the president's handling or mishandling, in their mind, of the COVID-19 outbreak as a disaster, which has cost many thousands of lives that people didn't have to die in this had they been more organized with this and used a plan that was already in place to deal with pandemics. And yet, Republicans at large still have high praise for his handling of this, and they oppose a lot of the scientific efforts to keep the country closed down in the face of this pandemic. And the result is that among Republicans, his handling of this crisis hasn't had much impact on his popularity ratings because we're so and even at large, his popularity ratings are the same. So the result is that among Republicans, his handling of this crisis has not had much of an impact. And in 2016, he overcame the criticism of John McCain. He overcame The Billy Bush bus ride. He overcame a lot of other things that would have ended the candidacy of other candidates. And in 2016, you said you thought that Trump was singularly unqualified to lead this country. Given all of that, do you guys have a ghost of a chance of making a dent in public opinion and the outcome of the election?
Absolutely. And remember, this is the real Republican voice, I would submit. The Democrats are going to have their campaign, their voice, their perspectives. What we're trying to do is articulate a traditional message of conservative principles, but respect for a free press, respect for separation of powers, where the U.S. Senate does its job in keeping in check an executive that wants to grab any and all powers. So I have no doubt that we will be, I mean, just in the last day, 2 days, a former Republican legislator has signed on with our Republicans for a new president. I talked with a current sitting South Carolina legislator, Republican, longtime Republican, who's signing on. I mean, people are coming out of the woodwork because they understand in so many different ways what an abject failure Trump's administration has been. The pandemic, not least of which. I mean, there's a very interesting book by Michael Lewis called The Fifth Risk. And it talks about, you know, Republicans kind of kick government, but when you really look at what the government does to protect our lives, from food safety to regulation of nuclear waste on down the line, it has an important role. And Trump's crowd just essentially ignored all of that, ignored the pandemic warnings, and the country is paying the price both health-wise and economically. And I would say one of the big campaign themes of Trump's run in 16 was, oh, we're going to get rid of Obamacare. But the pandemic has demonstrated a lot of really terrible failures about the healthcare delivery system in this country for the richest, most powerful country in the world. And I like part of it.
And Trump, he's still trying to get rid of Obamacare. He took on the establishment and established rules of conduct, established rules of thought, and successfully overturned most of them. The rule of law is in jeopardy in a lot of people's minds because of the way he and his attorney, attorney general are operating. And a lot of traditional Republicans went ahead and supported him. Does that mean they never believed in the ideals of the Republican Party in the first place, Dr. Tellis?
Well, again, I think the idea, you know, in some sense, the little spat that Bob and I had earlier is about the fact that the traditional values of the Republican Party is a little bit of a misnomer, right? The Republican Party had, especially in places like the South, and I should correct Bob, My mom's side of the family are from South Carolina, so I know your part of the country pretty well. It was a divided party with a lot of different pieces, and it was capacious enough to include, you know, free marketeers and post segregationists and all kinds of groups who got got put together in a new way in the 1970s and 1980s, and one thing I think I'll say is I do think what Republicanism is going to be different when Trump is not at the center of it. When people aren't being forced to actually defend this particular president with all of his idiosyncrasies, right? If Trump loses in 2020 and the Republican, especially if he loses big, right? The Republican Party is going to go through a really wrenching conflict about why that happened and what happened, especially if the Democrats take over the Senate and House and people are saying, you know, the reason why we have this huge wave of Democratic governance that's going in the opposite direction of what we want is because we put all our chips down on Trump. I think you're going to see some weird, we're not going to return back to what you might call traditional Republicanism. It's going to be a new kind of synthesis that's going to synthesize some of the fact that the Republicans have a more downscale electorate that they have to appeal to, with the fact that you're going to have to do so in a way that in part, you know, is backward compatible with the kind of Republicanism that Bob is talking about. And I think that's going to happen because you're going to have an organized Bob Orr faction and an organized more downscale populist faction. And they're going to have to find some way to actually occupy this Republican Party together.
So things may be changing, Bob. I said in the beginning that 90% of Republicans support Donald Trump, but a recently released Rasmussen poll, which I think came out just in the last couple of days, and the Rasmussen poll is run by a conservative organization, they found that 23% of likely Republican voters think the party should find someone other than Trump to be their nominee. Is this just the results of different polls at slightly different times, or are you seeing a shift in the mind of people out there who are voters?
Well, I certainly think people are recognizing how bad this administration's been. And he was the luckiest president in a long time by having this booming economy. So he could screw up all these other things, but he could always point to the market and the economy. And the failure in the pandemic and the resulting economic disaster to this country gives him nothing, no accomplishments other than maybe the judiciary, but they've also put in a bunch of less than qualified people to the federal bench. So I think it's a situation where what we have to do is reach out to uncertain registered Republicans, and here in North Carolina, into unaffiliated voters who lean Republican, and convince them there's a better choice. We can't stand four more years of Donald Trump. We'll deal with Joe Biden, but we know he will bring a degree of stability to the country.
I mean, I do think, and I hate to keep putting this factional point, but one thing that happened to the Democrats in the 80s, right, is they created an organization called the Democratic Leadership Council. And one thing that allowed people to do, especially in states like North Carolina, was to run for office and say, look, I'm not a national Democrat. I'm a DLC Democrat. I'm something different, right? And that's what, you know, there were a lot of successful North Carolina Democrats who ran that way, including Jim Hunt. And I think that that may be the future of what Republicans need to do. Now, I think North Carolina is going to, just to be honest, that's a tough nut to crack. But Massachusetts, Maryland, you know, they already elect Democrat. They already elect Republican governors essentially as adult supervision for a Democratic legislature. And I think there's a bunch of states like that where if you could run as some distinct party brand, right, not as a Trumpite populist Republican, but as a distinct kind of Republican, you actually could be effective in that way. And that would provide at least enough leverage for these never Trump type Republicans to actually have real power and leverage in the party, even as a minority.
Let's talk about the dividing line. I'm going to start with you, Dr. Tellis. What does it mean? What is Trumpism? How would you define Trumpism, which is what Donald Trump's fans see themselves as, Trumpers?
Well, again, I mean, one thing, problem is, right, how do you distinguish Trump from Trumpism, right? On one level, Trump is simply a leadership principle, right? It means support of this particular president. And again, I do think it's important to recognize that a large part of Donald Trump is simply that he's a demagogue. And demagoguery, traditionally going all the way back to ancient history, is about a kind of leader who melds with the crowd, right? Who appeals to the sort of lowest basest element and gives people what they want in that sense. And so there's a part of Trumpism, which is simply Trump. And then I think there's a longer, attempt in the Republican Party to reorient its especially economic message in a different direction, which has some elements on immigration, has a lot of elements about industrial policy, about about support for low-income workers, right? Those are all things where the actual people who vote for the Republican Party were not being well served by the economic policy of it before. And so part of Trumpism is, and you can think of as distinct from Trump himself, is an effort to figure out a economic policy that actually makes sense for the people who actually vote for, and that for Republicans, and that may outlast the president himself.
So as a never Trumper, Bob Orr, the people who remain in the Republican Party and who are Trumpers call you, they call you a rhino. You're a Republican in name only. I would think you would turn the that title back on them. Are they Republicans in name only? And if so, what does the Republican Party stand for today?
Well,
your
today
Republican,
stands
your Republican, you know, your Republican Party.
My Republican Party stands for the constitutional principles, sort of the fundamental issues of free trade, a strong defense, trying to be fiscally responsible, yet addressing problems that, you know, need federal government attention. But the never Trump message is one of ridicule. It's one of being punitive towards anybody who doesn't sign on and go worship at the feet of Trump. It violates every single concept that over 45 years of being involved in Republican politics. So when they say that I'm a rhino, I'll put my Republican credentials up against any of them.
So before we run out of time, because we have about 3 minutes left, I have to bring this up. The Republican Party, the National Republican Party, your party, has endorsed Joe Biden for president. I want to know how difficult that is for you to put together in your mind. And in addition to supporting Biden, the National Republicans are hoping for a Republican vice president on the Biden ticket, like Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice. And I know that Condoleezza Rice was encouraged by somebody to run against Donald Trump in 2016, and she steadfastly refused to do so. So how do you feel about endorsing Biden, and do you really think a Republican vice president on the ticket would be possible?
You know, it's possible. I think it's highly unlikely. You know, it would take really sort of the perfect person, and I'm not sure who that would be. Condoleezza Rice certainly would be eminently qualified. But, you know, as we have said, it's a binary choice. And one of the things that I think is beneficial to our effort to defeat Trump is the choice between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton was stark. I mean, I had countless people say, I don't like Trump, but I could never vote for Clinton. I think that's different with Joe Biden. I think there are a lot of people that are far more comfortable voting for Joe Biden than they are for the 4 more years of chaos.
So, Dr. Tellis, when he was saying that, you were nodding in agreement about the people finding Biden more palatable. In the minute or so we have left, why do you think that's true?
Well, I think, you know, Hillary Clinton played a very particular role in the history of the last 20 or 30 years, right? She had a particular kind of, even as ideologically, especially on foreign policy, she was not, you know, not that liberal. She supported the Iraq War. That really, you know, she was a real hate figure in some important ways. And Joe Biden is real, doesn't have that kind of emotional resonance where it's just like, I can't bite it. I can't eat it, right? Joe Biden, I think, feels like at the margin, a less hard thing to swallow. Now, again, I still don't think there are going to be a lot of Republicans switching over to vote for Biden. But in a lot of states, you don't need that many. And you don't need that many who just, you know, maybe decide to sit, you know, stay home rather than to go out and hold their nose.
So Kent emails that he's a registered Republican, a never Burr, never Tillis, never Hudson Republican, but he says there are a lot more never Bidens than never Trumpers. I have 5 seconds. Is that true, Bob Orr?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Bob Orr is a constitutional conservative, former member of the North Carolina Supreme Court, and the head of the National Republican Party, Dr. Stephen Tellis, the author of Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites. Thank you both for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.